Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of the group People for the American Way, who examines the constitutionality of President Trump's declaration of a national emergency he's using to bypass Congress to secure funding for his U.S.-Mexico border wall. Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, who talks about why he believes Bernie Sanders, now making his second run for the White House, remains the authentic progressive in a growing field of Democratic candidates. And Amy Griffin, associate head coach at the University of Washington, who explains why she believes there's a link between artificial turf crumb rubber athletic fields and cancer. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the Trump White House has imposed harsh economic sanctions and threatened military intervention to depose Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in favor of opposition leader Juan Guaido, the U.S. government has slammed the door shut on refugees fleeing Venezuela's economic and political crisis. According to the American Prospect, the Trump administration has deported more Venezuelans in the past few months than it has resettled Venezuelan refugees in years. In October and November of last year alone, immigration officials deported more than 120 Venezuelan nationals. Meanwhile, the U.S. has not resettled a single Venezuelan refugee since 2013, nor does it have any plans to do so in the near future. Despite the crisis in Venezuela, immigration judges in the U.S. have denied roughly 50% of all asylum applications made by Venezuelans over the past five fiscal years. Adriana Kostenki, head of the Venezuelan American National Bar Association, accused the Trump administration of being hypocritical. Since becoming president, Trump has slashed overall refugee admissions into the U.S. by two-thirds and ended temporary protected status for people fleeing violence and repression in Haiti, El Salvador, and Sudan. Forces loyal to Libya's eastern leader Khalifa Haftar have taken control of Al-Sharara, the country's largest oil field. Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army drove out armed groups who had closed down the 300,000-barrel-per-day facility in December, demanding more money and investment in the remote region. Haftar's forces pledged earlier to hand the field over to the National Oil Corporation once it was fully secured. Since the ouster of authoritarian leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, Libya has been engaged in a bloody civil war between rival militia groups. The United Nations plans to convene a national peace conference, possibly in March, bringing together the interim government and multiple rebel factions. It is hoped that the talks will lead to either parliamentary or presidential elections and a new constitution. The UN is still trying to win an agreement by those attending the meeting for a broad agenda. The head of Libya's state-owned oil company said he wants to organize a national armed force to protect the country's petroleum assets after repeated seizures by militia groups. Mustafa Sanalla, chairman of the National Oil Corporation, said his plan for a national non-tribal oil installation protection force should start with a pilot project in Al-Sharara once it was secured. 3 years ago, Chicago community activists shook the city's political establishment when voters ousted Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez in a primary over widespread outrage over the police killing of Laquan McDonald. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, tarnished by the McDonald killing and his delay in releasing the police video of the shooting, won't run for a third term, creating a historic opportunity for progressives to sweep out Chicago's entrenched old guard in City Hall. 14 candidates are running for mayor in the first round of elections on February 26th. Top candidates include Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle and community organizer Amara Enya, both running on progressive platforms. In These Times magazine reports, progressive candidates are pledging to reopen mental health clinics, invest in schools, and shake up Chicago's scandal-ridden police department. The left-leaning Chicago Teachers Union endorsed Preckwinkle on her pledge to establish an elected school board and impose a moratorium on school closings, charter school expansion, and school privatization. The Chicago establishment is backing candidates such as former Obama Chief of Staff Bill Daley and businessman Willie Wilson. What is different in 2019 is the level of mobilization by grassroots activists to defeat Chicago's entrenched Democratic Party machine. Amisha Patel, director of the Grassroots Collaborative, maintained, "The number one reason we have this electoral moment is absolutely the organizing of young Black people responding to massive police brutality." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Trump, pivoting off his surrender to Congress's refusal to allocate the $5.7 billion he demanded to build his southern border wall, declared a national emergency on February 15th. As the White House telegraphed for weeks, the emergency declaration was a desperate ploy to bypass Congress to take money allocated for other purposes to fund the U.S.-Mexico border wall Trump pledged to construct during his 2016 election campaign. In a disjointed speech made in the White House Rose Garden, Trump repeated his standard lies about the need for a border wall to address what he falsely claims to be a national security threat of violent crime committed by immigrants and to stop a flood of illegal drugs entering the U.S. from Mexico. MoveOn.org and a coalition of groups across the U.S. organized protests in 48 states on February 18th that attracted the participation of at least 50,000 people demonstrating their opposition to Trump's emergency declaration. In addition to proposed legislation to overturn Trump's move to divert funds for the wall, now making its way through Congress, 16 states have filed a federal lawsuit challenging the national emergency declaration, which will likely be heard by the Supreme Court during the 2020 election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who examines the constitutionality of President Trump's declaration of a national emergency to get his wall and the possible long-term damage to the rule of law and democracy.
We're firmly opposed to it and believe that it is an astonishing power grab, even more astonishing than what Trump has done already, that violates not only the National Emergencies Act, but the Constitution itself in its attempt to literally and unilaterally override a decision by Congress, Republicans and Democrats, by the way, not to give Trump the money he wants for this border wall.
Just in terms of the constitutionality of Trump's emergency declaration, maybe you could explain a bit to our audience about provisions within the United States government for a president to invoke emergency powers. What has been the norm until this move by Trump, and what we can expect in terms of constitutional challenges to what he's done here?
Sure. They're both constitutional and statutory. The major authority for a president to declare a national emergency is from the National Emergencies Act passed by Congress, which gives a president fairly broad discretion in figuring out what an emergency is, but has a couple of very important limitations that I hope will be very important. First, there are limits on what purposes that you can use a national emergency to justify spending that hasn't been authorized by Congress. And we think it's very clear that those limits have been breached by the plans as announced by Trump and the White House, and that even if, by some incredible stretch, one considered this an emergency in any sense of the word, he doesn't have the statutory authority to spend these billions of dollars on the wall that he wants to spend it on. But the other thing that the National Emergencies Act does is provides at least some element of check and balance with the legislative branch. What can happen under the Act, and it's already underway in the House, one House can pass a resolution that essentially condemns the National Emergency Declaration and tries to revoke it, says, no, there really is no such emergency. We don't agree with the president. And if the House passes that, as we expect it will, then the Senate by law has 15 days to vote yea or nay on the Senate floor. No filibuster, no delay, gotta happen. And that's the critical vote where Republican as well as Democratic votes need to stand up and be counted. If both houses rebuke President Trump, he still can veto that, unfortunately, and it will take a large majority, two-thirds, to override that veto, but that's still possible. If there's enough citizen activism around the country from people pressuring both Democratic and Republican legislators to essentially revoke his astonishing emergency declaration. If that doesn't work, then I think the courts are our major alternative, which I'm happy to discuss.
In your view, what is the long-term damage to our democracy and the role of Congress as an independent branch of government in our Constitution if this emergency declaration is let to stand?
If Trump gets away with this, he and future presidents can effectively become dictators in the United States. What does a foreign dictator do? Usually, they go to their alleged Congress before they do something. And if Congress doesn't give them what they want, they do it anyway. That's exactly what Trump is trying to do now. And that kind of action by Trump, if not checked by Congress and by the courts, could lead America to going right down that road. And indeed, there are many Republicans who worry that future Democratic presidents may use this to justify unilateral action on climate change or on gun control, causes that I personally believe in quite strongly, but do believe that in our democracy have to involve both the president and the Congress in taking action.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Find more commentary on Trump's emergency declaration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As expected, 77-year-old independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined the already crowded field of Democratic candidates vying to be the party's presidential nominee in the 2020 election. Sanders, who defied conventional wisdom with his unexpectedly strong run against Hillary Clinton in the 2016 Democratic primary, is credited with moving the party to the left on a host of issues he championed in his earlier campaign. His advocacy of universal health care through Medicare for All, moving to a national $15 minimum wage, and tuition-free public college have become mainstream positions among most of the 12 Democratic candidates who've already launched their campaigns. A recent Morning Consult poll found that among Democratic primary voters nationwide and in early voting states, former Vice President Joe Biden led the pack, followed by Sanders, California Senator Kamala Harris, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and a California Sanders delegate to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He's currently a coordinator of the recently relaunched Bernie Delegates Network. Here Solomon addresses recent criticisms leveled at Sanders regarding sexual harassment claims during the 2016 campaign and his relationship with the nation's black community, while maintaining that Bernie remains the authentic progressive voice in a growing field of Democratic candidates.
On the surface, there is a lot of cohesion and willingness to say what Bernie has been saying for years, actually decades, for instance, about the need for Medicare for All, the need for free public college education, the need to see human rights in economic terms as rights, not privileges, the right to a job, an opportunity, not just an opportunity, but a reality. So on the surface, a lot of these candidates have been understanding that there is a progressive undertow and wave that has swept this country very visibly in the last couple of years since the 2016 election, and they don't want to be left behind. In baseball terms, they don't want to be leaning the wrong way on the base paths and get picked off. They're trying to win. They want to be with the current zeitgeist. But what's different about Bernie? He's not on the surface. He hasn't just been saying these things for a few months or a year or two. This has been his entire political career and indeed his activist work before that. So people really are going to be faced with the choice of whether they're going to go for candidates that put on the fashion clothes of this particular historic moment or whether they're going to go for the real deal.
And I wondered if you would comment, Norman, on a flurry of recent attacks on Bernie Sanders, including accusations he didn't do enough to address sexual harassment, allegations made against some of his 2016 campaign staff. There was also a recent New York Times story on Bernie's, as they termed it, troubled relationship with the African-American community in this country during his 2016 campaign. It seems to be a feature of presidential campaign coverage in 2020 that Bernie's on the receiving end of a lot of barbs here.
To put this in context, when Bernie ran for president, announced and began running in 2015, first he was ignored and disparaged by the news media. It was predicted by some he would barely, if at all, get out of single digits in the primaries. And when from the grassroots the campaign gathered momentum, there were ferocious attacks from the corporate mass media. The Media Watch Group FAIR, where I'm an associate, released a study at the time of the Michigan primary. This is when Bernie was really, really gaining momentum. And on the eve of that very decisive primary, which he, by surprising the pundits, actually won, the Washington Post published 16 negative stories about Bernie in 16 hours. Not in 16 weeks or 16 days, but 16 hours, 16 negative stories by the Washington Post. And that just tells you the ferocity of some of the major media hostility towards Bernie. Now, is it a coincidence that the owner of the Washington Post is the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, who also owns, as well as the Post, Amazon and Whole Foods and so forth? Bernie has been campaigning against the oligarchy. So that said, certainly this is not a justification, but just an explanation. Every large campaign has some really bad things that go on with thousands and thousands of volunteers and supervisors. And clearly, Bernie Sanders should have done a better job of making sure that to the maximum extent possible, there were strict rules that were conveyed to volunteers and supervisors and employees about sexual harassment. And we have to hope, and we're certainly advocating for him to do a much better job as the candidate in that way, as he has said he will. In terms of African-American voters, there's no doubt that Hillary Clinton simply crushed Bernie in the South among African-American voters fairly early on in the campaign. But it's also true, according to exit polls and public opinion polls, that by the end of the primary season, Bernie had more support among African-American young people than Hillary Clinton did. And what we didn't get from the recent New York Times very high-profile story is the fact that a recent CNN poll showed that among people of color, Bernie is the most, not the second or third, but the most favored candidate for president for 2020. So it all depends, unfortunately, on how it spun. And Bernie has had a lot of hills to climb going from a Vermont senator to a presidential candidate. I think that this campaign is going to have a lot of momentum. I have no idea whether he'll be the nominee, but I think he has a great shot at it. I think that what we're seeing is some real public discourse and label shifting, and it's hard to know how that will sift out. But I would say this. When we have a lot of candidates running for president who have been shifting their policies with the wind, going the way the wind seems to be blowing, when they perceive the wind shifting, perhaps after getting the nomination, they could easily, in character, shift back in another direction. Bernie doesn't blow with the wind and shift with the wind. He has helped to create a progressive wind, and that is a very big difference. It's crucial that Trump be defeated, or if Trump doesn't run, that Pence or some other Republican who does run in 2020, that person has to be defeated. Bernie has as good a chance, at least, according to polling, to defeat the Republican in 2020 as any other prospective nominee of the party. So let's go with what we believe in instead of going with fairly hollow candidates.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and a coordinator of the recently relaunched Bernie Delegates Network. Find more analysis and commentary on Bernie Sanders' 2020 candidacy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Amy Griffin, associate head coach at the University of Washington, has worked with the same demographic of students for 24 years. She never knew a soccer player who had cancer until 2009. What began as a list of two goalkeepers with cancer that year has now grown to a list of 260 players from various sports, but most are soccer players, and goalkeepers make up 59% of the total. Although Coach Griffin acknowledges that correlation is not causation, the rising incidence of cancers has occurred as more and more athletic playing fields of natural grass have been replaced with artificial turf fields made of crumb rubber infill produced from ground-up recycled tires. Goalkeepers among all soccer players have the most contact with the crumb rubber. In early February, Griffin, an award-winning soccer coach, spoke at a forum sponsored by the Yale University School of Public Health. She shared with the audience data she's collected on the incidence of cancer among players she's coached over the years. Recognizing that while she's not a scientist, Griffin is urging the scientific and public health community to thoroughly research the possible link between artificial turf fields made of crumb rubber and cancer.
EPA, they're in charge of keeping us safe from environmental factors. They were the ones that said, you know what, these tires are toxic. So you can't throw them away, and you can't burn them, and you can't bury them. You can't. It's illegal. We're going to have a tax on these tires so that we can afford to collect them in a safe way and get them out of the environment and make sure that you don't do anything stupid with them, and we'll keep them for you. But that added another problem onto their list. What do you think happened to all the places where they were collecting them? They were overflowing with tires. They have nowhere to put these really unsafe, really toxic, dangerous things. So they actually ended up sponsoring the growth of crumb rubber to solve their waste challenge. So the government actually subsidizes communities that use crumb rubber fields. So in the state of California, I don't know, 5 years ago, $6.1 million went to help the parks and recreational facilities in California because it was helping their waste problem, right? We were recycling these tires and we were breaking them up into millions of pieces and getting them out in our community so that our kids are playing on trash. And then there's the RCRA law. So it's the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And basically it's in charge of ensuring that we manage our waste in environmentally safe and sound ways, which is why you couldn't take a tire out because it's toxic waste. But what's not regulated is if you turn it into a different product. If you turn it into a different product, and now it's no longer a tire, it doesn't follow the same regulations. So then what's crazy is they have very short lifespans, right? So these fields, they took them out of the dump, and now they're like, wait, they have to be hauled back into the dump again because the fields only last 6 to 10 years. So now they're stuck with the same problem they had to begin with. Only worse is because these are chopped up into millions and millions of little pieces, and there's no net waste gain. Now, you know, 5% of these fields every year disappears into the waterways and into our shoes. So now the chemical leaching from fields, the EPA doesn't really treat it as a point source, so therefore it's not monitored. And so the runoff just goes into your rivers and your lakes and your coasts, basically. And there's no regulation as to where it's disposed. So my list of athletes continued to grow. So at 9, I started writing it on a yellow notepad, okay? So, and then the list of 9 grew to 35, grew to 50, grew to 75, and now, as of a couple days ago, it's at 260. Remember, in order to get on this list, you have to have heard a story seen an article, taken the time to find my name and number, and then get on the list. Okay? So, anecdotal. It's just a list. It's my research. Okay? I haven't ever deleted anyone from the list, so some of them play other sports. We're now at 119 goalkeepers, and that's 59% of the people on my list. That percentage has always been between 59 and 61%. It has never changed as the numbers have grown. All right, so what does the data show? Okay, that data shows, in my mind, absolutely nothing. This is why you guys are here. This is why you guys are listening. I know that correlation does not equal causation. I have learned that. So I've got these numbers, and some of them, there's some red flags to me. There's some things that make me really, really concerned. Three of the Hodgkin lymphoma were age 14, diagnosed at 14, and they were diagnosed at stage 4, which apparently is really, really rare. And these are the blood-related cancers, which I've been told have been tied to an environmental association of some sort or another. And then here are some of the others that are on my list. The median age for thyroid cancer is 39. This is based on the American Cancer Society. Diagnosed between the age of 0 to 20, there's a chance that happens 1.9%, and 10 of the 11 were diagnosed between the ages of 16 and 26. Also, the ovarian cancer, I think it's very concerning that the ages are 14, 15, 23, and 24. Very rare in people under the age of 40. The median age is 63. And then the lung cancer, 100% of them goalkeepers, all three diagnosed at the age of 19, 26, and 27. None of them were smokers. So that's the data that everyone's talking about. And the reason I think this has become a story, and the reason I think that I'm here, if there is a reason, is that for every statistic that scientists and toxicologists are working on, I have a human face to attach to this. And it's these people's stories and their deaths and their concerns that have made this very interesting.
That was University of Washington soccer coach Amy Griffin. Learn more about the possible link between artificial turf athletic fields made of crumb rubber and cancer by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.